just be with Jim, speak through him, we pray. Help us all to connect with your heart, in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you also for the encouragement from some of you who found bits of what we did yesterday helpful. Again, I'll come into the session now. We've got 2 hours together, so the last thing I want to be doing over the whole 2 hours is for this to be me as a kind of didactical, kind of standing at the front, kind of teaching stuff. But what I want to try and do is promote as much conversation in the room around the stuff that I'll be presenting and talking about as possible. So I'll be throwing some questions out there, but if at any point you've got a question you want to stop me for any clarification at all, or your own reflections on stuff I'm talking about, then do that, and it'll just open up the conversation as well. One of the beauties as well I like around doing these kind of events is that you get to talk to people by sitting at breakfast or sitting at dinner. And on the presentations I've done, I've changed the presentations and put things in according to conversations I've had. Because the idea being, this is fluid stuff. Your experience is as valid as anybody else in this room, including mine. And I want to try and bring your experience into what we're talking through and having a discussion about how that fits and what does that mean and where do we go with these things. So yesterday, I talked briefly around the Seinfeld model of how you're working within different spaces of what's known or unknown, and this dynamic of between, are we talking about technical change or adaptive change in what we're doing? Are we looking towards getting something that we know in, something out of the box, a tool that's useful, which tends to be a technical change approach? Or are we talking about an adaptive change thing where we're looking about how do we change the system of what's going on? We also talked yesterday a little bit around the parable of the three chimps. The three chimps with the stepladder and the bananas. And what's going on with that and how do you bring about culture change within organisations and some of the dynamics involved in that. Today, and as I said, I want to talk about two areas and split it to this morning be a session of two distinct halves. The path of descent and the path of descent, but different types of descent. Descent, which is around how do you encourage somebody who's swimming against the tide? And what is that person who's swimming against the tide doing? What do they look like? Or how do we support them? And the second descent is walking down a path of descent through, as I'll say more about later, through Gethsemane as a group of people. And what does that involve? And why is that significant? Why are we called into doing that? Good. A little bit of kind of context in terms of my own story in terms of these things. There are a few people I've worked with in the past who I consider very close and good friends. Some of you might know of Pete Ward, who wrote Liquid Church, is an old, long-standing friend of mine. I met Pete in 1988 when he was a youth worker, and I trained at Oxford Youth Works with Pete and with Kenny Wilson and some of the other guys on Oxford Youth Works. And then a couple of years later, I ended up working with Simon Hall in Revive in Leeds. Some of you might know about Simon's a long-term friend. So often these dissenting voices are people that I've aligned my own path to kind of spiritually in different ways. And that's shaped and formed me and helped me in different ways. And I'll come to kind of talk about their stories and bring different perspectives from different dissenters into what we're talking about. What do we mean by dissent? Helps if you press the right PowerPoint. I won't press mine, which you can't see. That's not going to be any help at all. Should come along in a minute. There we go. Cool. What do we mean by dissent? This is a chap called Gerald Arbuckle. So Gerald Arbuckle, Catholic writer and thinker, one of three Catholics I've worked with. I'm very proud, three Catholics I've worked with. Each of them have received a letter of cease and desist from Cardinal Ratzinger. So it's good. And for them, they never say it's a badge of honour, but when they talk about it, it's really a badge of honour. They've had the cease and desist letter from Cardinal Ratzinger, and they can kind of wear it. Jerry's one of them, Gerald Arbuckle. He's now 83 years old, and he wrote this in 1993. He said, there can be no constructive change at all, even in church, unless there is some form of dissent. By dissent, I mean simply the proposing of alternatives, and a system that is not continuously examining alternatives is not likely to evolve creatively. I could have put it also a quote, but there's a longer piece of work done by Simon Walker of the Undefended Leader work, of which he's fundamentally saying the same thing. Any organisation, any system that is unable to carve out within it a place, a safe place for dissent, for someone to say, hold on, what's going on here? Do we need to be doing something different? I think I've found something different. I think we should be doing I think we should be trying this out. If the system doesn't have that within itself, it's by nature going to fall over at some point in the future because it's not being prepared for what that future looks like. The most classic examples of this are, I'll bring up two, they're both in the technological industries. IBM is a classic of actually when IBM was where it was, and it was this big monolith, and you had the lead of IBM at the time said, I don't see any need for more about 10 or 11 computers in the world. Yeah? You had at the same time, strangely within IBM, although subcontracted to it, Bill Gates, who said, no, I've got a vision for a computer in every office and in every house. Completely alternative views of what that reality, that future reality might look like. But it's because IBM had this, well, actually, they were kind of strong-armed into it by Bill Gates and others into saying, no, you've got to go with us. We can develop this MS-DOS system, Microsoft DOS system, that will give you a flexible platform to be able to apply across more PCs. And they said, okay, we'll go with it, but you need to develop it quickly. And they said, yeah, we'll develop it within 3 months. And they did, and they rattled this thing out. Oddly enough, the fact they rattled it out in such a short period of time was why we ended up with PCs that were problematic for such a long time, why we've ended up with the whole virus challenge that we've had, which didn't occur with Apple. Apple was on a different path, was looking much more towards going, that's great, this MS-DOS thing, but actually you need to be a bit of a geek and a nerd to see it, and can you not see the interface is a challenge in terms of engaging with it? So Steve Jobs, interestingly, then said, okay, so the interface, how someone interacts with this thing is really significant. And he ended up doing courses in calligraphy in order to understand how the reception of information, how we receive it through and on the screen changes our relationship with the technology. But it wasn't until mobile technology took off that actually you saw Apple kind of come into their own and become a dominant place in the market force. So they held a place for dissent within what they're doing. Interestingly enough, do any of you know the name, and now I've forgotten it out of my own head, I worked with his sister, Johnny Ive. Johnny Ive has a sister called Alison Ive. We worked together at Oxfam. Johnny, and you got an iPhone on you? Yeah, great. Johnny was the guy who designed the iPhone. Before that, he designed the iMac. His father comes from a Christian family. His father was a jewelry designer. And you might think, what's jewelry design got to do with this? Steve Jobs met with Johnny and said, your industrial design looks like it's been made by the hand of a jeweler, because it was, because that was his father. And he liked that, because again, it's the interface of the technology with the person they realized would enable people to engage with technology in a different way. And now I'm sat here, I own an Apple Watch, my brother bought it for me, bless him, for my last birthday. But now we've got items of technology that are jewelry. And the wearable tech thing is now kind of moving forward in a way that we just couldn't have perceived in the past. Because you had dissenters. Now, I'm stood here talking to a bunch of Baptists about dissenters and Anglican. Yeah. I hope you've got the irony of this. Welcome back to the fold. They were so pleased when I said I was going to speak to Baptists. Not at all. But any system, regardless in terms of the formation and reformation of what we're doing, has to hold a place for itself as dissent. Go. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say I can only imagine there being 11 computers. But that's because they're the size of a warehouse and they're cooled by water.
Yes.
And so what couldn't be seen, and this is, I'm trying to put it back with this kind thing for a moment, which I can't help. But the PC, the microprocessor, was that? So Bill Gates could see that? It was a known unknown, or was it an for the guy that the 11
Well, he was. No, it wasn't, but he was working on the Seinfeld model. He was working, therefore, with a technical change issue. He was working according to what he knew, which was this is how computers work, this is what we're doing. Bill Gates had the beauty of being able to say, actually, with the development of microprocessors, this could change rapidly. Because at the same time that was being said, I've forgotten who was the guy who was saying, came up with the formula that said, microprocessors will double in power and halve in price every 2 years. Moore's Law? Moore's Law, thank you. So Bill Gates was sat there going, Well, that's interesting, because if Moore's law is true, this is going to revolutionize what we're doing. So he was able to see something differently.
See it, or was already there? He already knew that the quotes weren't married together, were they? This guy didn't say this when there wasn't microprocessors. He said it when there weren't microprocessors.
He was saying it on the cusp of the microprocessor
which
revolution.
Makes it look so stupid.
That's right. Yes, or they were kind of in that space between the two.
So he couldn't. It was a black swan kind of thing. You know, you couldn't possibly imagine it. I think IBM was still a place of constructive change. Was it?
Yes. Yes.
But he looked stupid, and the organisation looks behind the curve simply because you can't ever know an unknowable
unknown. No, you can't. That's
what blows my head with all this stuff.
I can understand that totally. Because actually, in terms of moving forward, especially when we apply it in our context, so we apply it in terms of what's our eschatology, how can we move into a place which we can't yet see, but what does that movement look like? We can start to kind of embrace some of that and look towards some of that, because it is very difficult. The other classic quote is there was a guy, I listened to it because I listened to a podcast around the death of David Bowie about people who had a relation who knew David Bowie. And one of them was in the early age of the internet, David Bowie was really interested in what the internet could do. And he tried to set up an ISP, an internet service provider, which he did for a short period of time. And he was brought onto Newsnight. And they were questioning him, saying, why are you interested in this internet thing? It's got no scope at all. And he quoted what this friend of his was, who was a technology guy, who said one of the early telephone companies said, I don't see the need for more than one telephone per town in the United States. So it's around the perceived need, often, and being able to see the need, and being our, and as Christians, our ability to be able to see as being fundamental to what's going on. And how do we see? And what are the voices that we listen to in that seeing? It would become critical.
It sort of concerns me that you're using Steve Jobs as a creative space kind of person when it's a lockdown ecosystem.
Yes. I can see that, because of the open system dynamic of it. Yeah, totally.
Not anymore.
It's changed to a different place.
Never was, but it's locked down. You've got to buy my machine and my system.
Oh, yeah.
It's beautiful, yes, but not constructive change.
But that's the place that we're talking about in one sense, and any metaphor or analogy you use is broken in some way. Any organisation is broken. There is no perfect system. Well, last thing I'd want to tell the church is become like Apple, because actually that itself is a broken place and a broken system. We're pointing towards something bigger. But they're helpful things as metaphors and analogies to help us get our heads around what this might look like. And also to understand how, in this instance, how disruption and how dissent works in the context of a whole ecosystem. But that's around that. That's cool. Good. The question becomes one of, for me, or what Arbuckle does then, is he says, in order for this to happen, you need two types of dissenters. And this, I hope, is going to be a great word of encouragement for this group in particular, because I see both of these two groups within this room today, had conversations with both. One is what he calls pathfinder dissenters. So the pathfinder dissenter is the individual or small group of individuals who say, we should be doing something differently here. We've got this idea. We want to create this space. We want to be doing something different in what's going on. And these guys, Arbuckle calls pathfinder dissenters. The next group of people he calls authority dissenters, which he says are equally important to what's going on. And the reason they're equally important is there's a dynamic relationship between them. Is within the system that you've got, which Arbuckle is referring to the Catholic Church, he's saying, if you simply have pathfinder dissenters, they'll always be on the edge of what's going on. And actually, they'll always have a really, really rough life. And they're always going to find this incredibly tough to live out this space as a fast pathfinder dissenter. So what you need in the system is authority dissenters. Those who are already in a place of authority to be able to say to those dissenters, it's great work, carry on. it's okay, you're okay. What can I do to resource you? How do we resource this work? How do I carve out a space for you in what you're doing to enable this to have a place within what we've got going on here? So within the Church of England, a lot of our authority dissenters now are actually bishops, and that's creating a great space for us. Not that the whole system becomes a dissenting system, because there's still good stuff happening within the inherited church model. There are still many churches that are thriving and great. And you see, you don't want everything to be about dissent. But the role that your bishops are playing is being able to turn around and work with the Pathfinder dissenters to say, great, how do we create space for you in what we do? You've got some interesting examples of how authority dissenters and Pathfinder dissenters have worked over the years as well. There's a great memo, if any of you have read it, from Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who was credited with developing the internet, inventing the internet, which he didn't. He was just a significant milestone within that process of creating the internet. But it was when he wrote to his boss, because he was working in CERN as a physicist, and said, actually, it would really help if I could spend a bit of time developing this language, which I call HTML, in order to be able for us to communicate a bit better. But it means I need to carve some of my time to be able to do it. And then the letter basically comes back from his boss and says, yeah, great, okay, do it, but don't tell anyone. So therefore, you had this relationship of a Pathfinder dissenter within that, but the authority dissenter was able to go, okay, yeah, find some space for it. How many of you identify as being Pathfinder dissenters in some shape or form? One. Okay. Little bits, yeah. How many of you can identify as being an authority dissenter? Good. Yeah. One of the reasons I would encourage some for you to prayerfully think and to meditate on what it means to be an authority dissenter is because of the amount of time that you've got. When you've got a church that's busy and big, you know, where you might be really kind of, you're feeling flat out with what you've got anyway, carving space for the new is very, very difficult. It's really, really difficult. We talked about this last night, talked about with Nigel, and how the tensions that are involved in doing that, especially for people with older congregations, the same within the Church of England. You know, in fact, my father-in-law, my brother-in-law is a chap called Dave Murray, who's a Baptist in Scotland working with gym membership. He's a personal trainer, and he's now forming ecclesial community around gyms. We share a father-in-law, which is my wife's husband and his wife's husband, as it were. And Willie, when we're in Scotland, he was a minister on the Isle of Lewis, because it's such a liberal place to work. And we're on the Isle of Lewis, and we arrived there for Christmas. Neither of us had kids at the time. It's first Christmas together, and I was over the dinner table, and me and Dave try and wind Willie up a bit in different ways, and he quite likes it because he's never had sons. And so we were sat over the dinner table, and this was the day before Christmas Eve, and I said, Dave, do you want to take a bet on how many people are going to die over Christmas? And Dave said, oh, I think it's 4. And I said, no, Dave, I think Will's going to be called out for 5. And Willie said, no, it's going to be 2. It's going to be 2. I'm having no more than 2. No more than 2. And I said, oh. In the end, it was 3 people died in that space between Christmas Day and New Year's Day on the island. So much of his time is spent burying the dead. But the privilege of doing that mustn't be taken away of what it is to work with a community of doing that. And the rituals over the funeral rituals on the Isle of Lewis, if you don't know them, are elaborate and significant. The coffin has to be carried by people, from the church to the graveyard. And that can often be a journey of 2 miles. And if it's a young person that's died to the town, the whole town will come out to carry the funeral, to carry the coffin from the church to the burial ground. So a lot of his time is spent in terms of those rituals, those important community events. So I'm not taking away from that. But how does he create the space for the new? How does he create the space for the dissenter in what he's doing? Is one of the only ways he can do that is to encourage a Pathfinder dissenter, which he found. So up on one of the estates, which was a newer estate in Lewis, found somebody who decided, actually, this was interesting. She was a single mum, had been divorced 2 times, came to faith 10 years before, really encouraged, fantastic disciple in the Lord, And she said, I'd like to start something on my estate. He said, right, how can I help you make this happen? So he found his Pathfinder Center when the rest of the church was going, what are they doing up there? Why are they meeting in a school hall? We have a church. Why aren't they joining us? This is proper church. Willie was able to say, it's okay. Stand back. Give her time. Allow her to do this gender into this as well on the Isle of Lewis. Significant factors. He was shifting around the culture. But he was able to preserve that and protect what was going on as an authority dissenter. He was dissenting all over the place, wasn't turning the apple cart of his church over when he was doing such amazing work with that community as it was. But he was able to create a space for that woman to start a church plant on one of the poor estates on Lewis. Do you see what's going on there? So that's really important. I loved this. Did any of you see this cartoon around the elections last year? Probably not. If you can't read it, I'll read it. So it's a guy, you can see, he's already on a plane, an aeroplane. And he stood up and he said, these smug pilots have lost touch with regular passengers like us. Who thinks I should fly the plane? How many of you in your congregational life feel like you've been in a meeting like that? There you go. Because I've got a question for you now, which is, how do you know, do you recognize a Pathfinder dissenter as being a good person to invest in? And how do you separate them from the person who simply wants to fly the plane within the communities that you've got? So just in twos or threes where you sat now, how can you identify for yourselves what's a good Pathfinder dissenter? That one, or the big one. That one.
I don't particularly like the quote, because there can be no constructive change unless somebody thinks about change. It's an almost oxymoronic.
No, not about thinking about change. Dissent, active dissent, active saying, "I know I'm not." Great. Can I gather people in? That'd be great. Good. So what did you come up with that might be some of your... There's some, got a question at the back there.
Sorry, I'm not sure it's directly. I'm struggling a little bit with some of this, but I wonder if you could just say a word or two about how that notion of the Pathfinder dissenters and the authority dissenters operated last week.
Thanks for that.
The media was the bishops were all united against changes that were being proposed by a large bunch of Pathfinder dissenters amongst the clergy. Was that how it was?
No. I think you've got, I think within political discourse, you've got a different thing going on. So all of this is trying to. So Polanyi, the famous philosopher economist, said all language is like a stick to a blind man. It gives you some sense of what is true, but it cannot truly reflect it because it's being mediated by language, okay? So, therefore, Polanyi said nearly all language is metaphor. So anything I'm doing in terms of models and things are us being able to use a little bit of a stick to a blind person. It helps you navigate your way around. And I think it works in some contexts and doesn't work with others. If I look towards the political change that's happening last week, we had a conversation around this last night. The difference between Rowan Williams and Justin Welby is Justin is a much more shrewd political maneuverer. So what he did very cleverly was get the bishops to approve a paper, which was basically saying, we need to be much more listening in regards to what's happening on the homosexuality debates and the LGBTQ discussions that are going on and what's happening in that. But we still want to affirm that marriage is between a man and a woman. And we need to also understand how the church can appear exclusive and a threatening place to people of alternative sexualities. But as a church, we want to affirm. So what he did was he gathered the bishops around that, which wasn't an easy thing to do. But he created it and framed it in a way that if they voted yes, we're affirming that paper, then it meant they're standing on the side of being marriages between the man and woman. If they vote no, because they think that's too liberal, that might make them look a bit too liberal. So therefore, he kind of carefully constructed that. So all apart from one bishop who pressed the wrong button, as we all know, Christopher Coxworth. Sorry? Very possibly. But then again, what's going on within that? So therefore, it frames the debate and it helps things to move along within the Church of England. So I think that was a political manoeuvring as much as anything. How do we keep everyone on the same table? Was Justin's concern in regards to this thing over a period of time. Around something that's pretty intractable. And where it will go, I don't know. I mean, Steve Bevins, who's a Catholic contextual theologian, came to speak to us at CMS 2 or 3 years and goes, the gay debate, we'll only know with time. We'll only know where God rests with this with time. It's pretty intractable in different ways. So how you see dissent or authority dissenters within that debate will truly depend on where your position is. Because some people say, no, I'm a Pathfinder dissenter because I'm keeping to a very strict traditional interpretation. And somebody's saying, no, I'm creating an open church because I'm a Pathfinder dissenter. And in one sense, both would be true. And, yeah, if that's okay. Well, that's probably a bit of a non-answer. But I'm an Anglican. Cool. So with your Pathfinder dissenters, how do you identify a good Pathfinder identify from this chap? Go.
It's, for me, it's when it's personal. So this guy stood up on the plane. It's personal. These pilots, they don't know what they're doing.
That's interesting.
Whereas generally, the Pathfinders that I come across that are worth investing in are people who, it's not personal, but it's something about the culture that they see in a different way or they're wanting to drive change through. But it's not a personal, Jeff's rubbish, therefore, let's do it like this. It's
yes. That's interesting. That's helpful. Anything else?
Focusing on the character and the motivation of the particular person or group that are wanting to dissent, because often I'll have people dissenting about structural things.
Yeah.
You know, we do church rubbish, let's do it this way. We need more leaders, we need fewer leaders, whatever it is, those things.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually the heart of the New Testament stuff is about, am I kind, am I humble, how do I relate to people? So if someone's dissenting about, we need to be nicer to poor people, and that person is nice to poor people, I'm interested in them.
Yeah.
If it's driven by a frustration with structure, that may not be. It's a lot about character and motivation of the person, rather than about the particular issue that they're talking about.
Nice one, thank you. Anything else?
If he was a pilot,
thank you.
And I've got both sorts in my church.
Yes.
And what you've talked about has been very useful.
Okay, thank you. Cool.
I would just like to suggest that the Pathfinder dissenter is very personal.
Mm.
That for them, it is change things. So I would say that, in my experience, personal dissenters have been extremely passionate and personal individuals.
Great. Thank you. When we come on to the next slide, can I ask you to do me a favour? At the top of your voice, just shout "story" at me, because it will remind me of something I've missed off. Thank you. That's great. That's good. But now I've said that to you, that might help me remember. Thank you. Mm. Say more.
Well, we're Baptists.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only authority we have, technically, is a church meeting.
Yes.
It consists of a bunch of dissenting people.
Yes. So, could anybody else respond to that?
Still a kind of a majority, still a sense of the majority voice tend to direct the church.
Yeah. Cool, thank you.
I'm just concerned that when we hear the word dissenter, you're using it in a technical term to mean something that isn't the same as a dissenter, that, you know, somebody that doesn't like things and we want to change things. I would say that a pathfinder dissenter, by your definition,
yeah,
a pathfinder dissenter may well be obnoxious, may well not be somebody we like, but actually if they are a pathfinder dissenter, by your definition of pathfinder dissenter,
they may be, yeah, good.
Imagined and seen,
yes.
Because that's the definition of a pathfinder,
yeah,
dissenter.
Yes.
Is that they have seen, imagined, and are doing and are acting in a new world. A
thank
new
you.
Creation.
Thank you.
They've already seen it.
Yes.
And they should already be doing it. And actually, there's nothing you can do about it because they're not working in your world by your rules, by your. So you can't really identify them.
Or if you have, you've identified them by the characteristics that you've just determined. But I want to come on back to that thing as well. Thank you for that.
I just wonder whether we are dissenters. We talk about being Baptist.
Yeah.
One of the things I struggle with when I think about that whole thing is that I wonder whether we've lost in your
charism.
Mm. What it really means to dissent, or whether to a large extent we're just kind of muddling our minds and saying this is who we are, this is who we were.
Thank you. Yeah, if your narrative, if the collective narrative is one of dissent, but the reality is something different, the reality doesn't matter. What matters is the collective narrative suddenly. It's the story we all tell ourselves, which isn't necessarily true. It's interesting, the Franciscan Father Richard Rohr, who some of you might have come across, talks about the crown of the church, of the bride of Christ. It contains jewels, each of which have been preserved by different denominations. And to me, it appears to me, the Baptist jewel, if I may be so bold as to present this to you as an Anglican, is this sense of the voice of God from the community as being actually, how do you preserve that jewel and polish that well in what's going on? I'm not quite sure what the Anglican one is. Mass, I don't know. So. But to me, there are a few people who have had that conversation with how do we learn as Anglicans from Baptists around the voice of the community as being the voice of God, and how do we discern that? Thank you.
I think radicals very quickly become traditionalists.
Yeah. Yeah. Spot on. Have you come across? That happens so often in what goes on. Oliver Cromwell is a perfect example of that in the English Reformation. You know, within a relatively short period of time, while the guy was still alive, he made himself king. Just insane, really, when you think about it. But one of the models, and again, Richard Rohr, amongst others, talk about this, is the movement between, as a movement starts, you start with a woman or man at the beginning that creates behind it a movement that then determines it wants to be a machine, which then becomes a monument. Or a monster. Yeah. And actually how quickly that can take place, it's true. What are some of the other characteristics we look for in terms of knowing this person's a good pathfinder?
See his license.
Sorry? To see his license. Speaking like an Anglican now. Go on.
Well, the word we were bandying around was the word trust.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of a local Baptist
Brilliant, thank you. One by the back there.
One of the problems is I've worked with two people, I would say, who have been Pathfinder dissenters in two different churches. I wasn't minister of the first one, but the first guy was a road sweeper.
Mm.
And he spoke with a very, very strong South London accent that people like me couldn't understand. And he always and he was taken hostage. But because Norman Kemper was a professor of physics, everybody in the church meeting, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but everybody in the church meeting took very seriously everything he ever said. And he was quite frequently very, very radical.
Showed. That's right. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Got a voice here.
Maybe if we're to be an authority dissenter, we should take the item that the chap has raised under AOB and put it as an agenda item for the next meeting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. Interestingly, about the Norman Kemper thing, I was trained in security management by the guy who was negotiating Norman Kemper's release from Iraq.
Right.
Funny how these things come round.
Well, I'll have a chat with you.
Yeah, do. One voice over here.
Character. Yeah. In terms of the Pathfinder, so they have a history of causing trouble with other people, inability to communicate well, showing a lack of fidelity, whatever they've been doing to that point, lack of love. But even then, as Peter sitting next to me was just saying, in a church situation, the person who's probably on the Asperger's spectrum had been knocked back for ministry.
Yeah.
But in one particular area, passion and their ability, wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we were talking, sort of, there's no clear tick list, really, except that the authority dissenter actually has the crucial role to discern what is of God, what is not, who to encourage, who to cocoon, so they can slowly develop and then let the cocoon break open. So that person who would normally be the pastor, that's a very... And concept that I haven't given much thought to.
Okay.
That's a very important part of the pastor's role.
But for me, in terms of change, I think it's a really critical role, the shaper of that stuff.
Not even just in terms of change, in terms of the dynamic of the congregation.
Yeah, good, good. One last voice from a new voice, if that's okay.
A question for you. Yeah. Do you think it's harder to hear the Pathfinder dissenters who are women than it is...
Yes. Yes. No, absolutely. Obviously, it depends on context, because if we were talking about a women's group, then that's a different environment. Broadly speaking, within the church, the voice of women has been excluded. And there's a vast array of different reasons for it. And actually, one of the things that we've done in terms of the pioneer thing is try to encourage equal applicants of women as men. And as trainers and as tutors, we're also trained in terms of gender to understand how it is that we can work in terms of gender equality and what we're doing to raise the voice of women. Interestingly, Rachel, name's gone from head, head of evangelism kind of research for Church of England, Rachel Jordan, thank you. Rachel Jordan did her PhD research on the planting of Pentecostal churches in the UK, almost solely done by women. Because actually the evangelist role was the only role which the Pentecostals saw was a legitimate role for women. So they went out and they planted these churches, but then the Pentecostal church said, and then you need to be followed by a man who can do the real work. There was one congregation who was formed under a Pentecostal evangelist woman, and the Pentecostal, they split with the Pentecostal movement because they said, no, we want this woman. This is the woman we want. This is the woman who brought us the gospel. This is the woman we want us to pastor. Sorry if you don't like it, bad luck. Everyone else said, oh yeah, it's the man's job around that. There's so many examples of that. And actually, the role of women in terms of being pioneer dissenters is significant. Our other question now is in terms of ethnicity. So with CMS, we're now asking the question, with the UK now being as significant a mission field as Uganda, I mean, I'll say this in a way, if you asked me, they said, Jim, you've got a choice. You can either serve as a missionary in Plymouth in an estate, or you can serve as a missionary in Kampala. I'd say I'll take Kampala, because it's easier. Because the brutality of working of the environment in a council estate in Plymouth is so much harder than Kampala. Now, of course, I'm picking Kampala for particular reasons. It's got a burgeoning middle class. It's got a thriving church. It's actually a pretty functional country and state in Africa. South Sudan might be thinking differently. But it says that their dynamics are changing. And how do we receive, as the white church in the UK, the voice of the global church in what we're doing? How do we receive the gifts of the global church in what we're doing? Is a big question for us at CMS.
Because interesting. In terms of Joe's point, a significant majority of those who have brought into the Forge mission training are women.
Yeah.
And I would say from last year's experience, a degree of underlying frustration in not being recognised, acknowledged, affirmed, released, given space to exercise what is a really significant ministry and mission. Mm.
I'll come back to this issue as well because it's pertinent to the next thing I'll go on to. I'll move on if it's okay. I agree with so much of what was said around there in terms of discerning, you know, this voice. How is this person? Is this person a pathfinder dissenter? This is another piece of work. Actually, it's the next slide that I need to shout out story. This is an interesting piece of work. This is done by a group called Ashoka. Ashoka are a non-Christian network of people who they've identified as being social entrepreneurs. So people who are kind of pathfinder dissenters within as it were, the social sector around non-profits and different ways of working within non-profits. So I've met a couple of what they call Ashoka Fellows, who are people, individual pathfinder dissenters, they don't use that term, they use social entrepreneurs, who change what they're doing in the system. One of them was a woman in Ireland who had a disability to change the perception of people with disabilities in Ireland, and that was her passion, that was her drive, and so she did that. And they've got them in all sorts of sectors in different ways. But they've got a model for how they, where they make an intervention with their pathfinder dissenters and how they discern what's going on. Okay, stages in an entrepreneur's life. They say everyone's got to start out at an apprenticeship. Everyone's got to do an apprenticeship, which is they acquire skills and experience, they learn the field, the problems, the players, the existing approaches, and they conceive and investigate, flesh out ideas. And typically people spend between 8 and 10 years in that. This is how they identify them. I'm not saying it's necessarily true or right. I think it's got problems in different ways, but this is their model. But it's got something to teach us. The next one is launch, which is where someone starts to devote 100% of their energy to launching an idea. They might be doing that towards the end of their time. I'll talk about that. But they're testing and refining their models and programs, and they're attracting support for what they do. And they subdivide in the early stages to demonstrate and refine and then begin spreading their idea of what it is they're doing. They do that in the 3 to 5 years. The takeoff is they're spreading that idea to regional, national ideas and consolidating an institution and building a movement around what they're doing. The last one is maturity, where an innovation is widely accepted in what's going on within a context. And the entrepreneur is recognized as significant in the field. Either they continue doing what they're doing or they move to a new idea in what's going on. Okay, this is quite interesting. I came across this when I was doing a piece of research for Tier Fund, which I'll talk about in a minute, around their pathfinders, which they called inspired individuals. I'll come to that in a minute. But this was interesting. When I was sat in a small group for us looking towards developing the pioneer training stuff that we were doing at CMS, myself and Johnny and a few others were in the room, and it was late in the evening, the whiskey had come out, because it does. We can't stop it. And we were sat talking, and they said, Jim, your brother's an entrepreneur. So what makes your brother an entrepreneur, and why are you not an entrepreneur? And I said, oh, it's interesting. I said, when we were kids, this is a true story, we didn't have Sunday trading. Who remembers the days before Sunday trading? Some of them in the room. Good. My brother used to, on a Saturday, run up to the sweet shop and stock up. And he'd stock up on all the penny sweets. Then on Sunday, he'd bring them back on the street and sell them to other kids to profit. My brother was the entrepreneur. I was the mug that bought them from him. It was a cruel lesson in the markets of the economic forces of supply and demand. But myself and other kids, you know, bought them for me. He was told off by the neighbors and told he couldn't do it, which is an interesting dynamic. So already at early stages, he was figuring out what was going on, how does this work, what can I do, where's the gap and where's the opportunity. And that's quite a common story amongst entrepreneurs, is they found something to do when they were still kids. My nephew is the same. My nephew, when he was 8 or 9 years old and eBay was just starting, he was running around the house trying to say, Mum, can I sell this? Mum, can I sell this? Mum, can I sell this? It's amazing there was anything left. So actually the shaping of these people sometimes is often kind of an early life thing as well. This is quite an interesting model. It helps us kind of think about things. We've meditated on this particularly around mission partners for us as CMS. So a classic mission, some of our mission partners are in classic this model. One of them's a woman called Jane Gerard, who was a school teacher for many years, for 30 years. 20 years she was a school teacher, otherwise she'd be dead now. And then she became a mission partner, became convicted to move to northern India, very rural communities, where there was almost non-existent primary education. There were low-caste people, so everyone said, actually, it's not worth investing in their kids' education. We've got to teach the kids to be good agriculturalists, and that's the job. So Jane had spent all this time developing her apprenticeship around teaching and education and working and moved to northern India. Had to let go of much of that to start working in this area where she was then going, okay, so I'm placed in the middle of northern India. I know I'm supposed to be doing something around education. What do I do? She found one other person there who was going, yeah, I've got a passion for this as well. 20 years later, she sustained 70 villages with their own independent self-financing primary schools. She won't tell you that. You have to grab it from her. She presented to our trustees a couple of weeks ago, and she was there, and we had to say, Jane, how many villages was this? She goes, 70. So how many schools per village? One per village. She goes, really transformed part of northern India and their attitudes and their beliefs towards their primary education. A real pathfinder, dissenter within the thing, but she had to find, in the context of mission, a local person she could work alongside to do that with. In one sense, and this is where the model between pathfinder dissenter and authority dissenter breaks down. She was both, because she was a white face in what was going on. And often and tragically within these contexts, people will listen to the white face and not to the brown face. And that's part of what do we do within those contexts is tricky and difficult. Go on. Really good question. There's a lot of talk around failure and not a great deal of research from my perspective in terms of looking at that. There is a lack of fear of failure because you have to do it, because actually the fear of failure is what stops almost all of us from doing anything. So we know that much, so we've got some understanding of that. So there is a lack of fear of failure. I'll give it a go, I'll try it. And actually for many people, starting out on the kitchen table is a safe place. I'll just start out on the kitchen table, I'll do it, and I'll test it, and I'll see what's going on. And within we were talking last night around the 72 programme, points of experimentation in what's going on, so you're free to experiment, limits that sense of risk. But there is a dynamic, which we do know, which says if you limit the risk too much, you're killing the hunger. That actually, if someone's risking in what they're doing, they're developing a hunger for what's going on. And if you try and make this too safe, it can kill that. And that, I think, is a problem for organisations and HR processes, which are designed to make them very safe places. So if you take some of the safety away, you can create a more vibrant place. Good, I'll come on to that, because that's around how do we support them. So it doesn't sound like it's supportive, but it's supportive. Places of accountability are critical. Cool. I'll move on to the next slide. By the way, if anybody wants slides of these, what I'll do is I'll leave my laptop at the back and you can punch your email address in and I'll just email them off to you. Okay. Good. Story. I heard that. Good. I created this because over breakfast I was chatting with someone around these dynamics, and I thought, oh, I should put this slide in, we should talk around this stuff. Supporting pathfinders. When I talked about a piece of research I did for Tier Fund, which is around their pathfinders, they had a question when they did a re-strategization under Matthew Frost, where they said, when we started Tier Fund, and they literally started, and the founder of Tier Fund almost literally walked around the world with a suitcase full of dollars. When he came across somebody they liked, and he thought, you're doing good work, out came the dollars. And he went on to the next place. And that was one of the founding stories of Tier Fund. And then one of their questions was, how do we find those people again? So they contracted me and they said, can you do a piece of research to try and identify how do we find these people? And when we found them, what can we do to resource them in what they're doing? And this has been helpful for us at CMS in terms of thinking about our Pathfinder dissenters and what do they need in terms of what's going on. Okay. Some things that we know in terms of how do we identify them first off. First thing is they're doing it. So it comes back into that story, how do you identify? They're doing it. They're not someone who says, I want to do, I think I should be doing. They're doing it. And actually, when we're creating the Pioneer course, that was a primary value to us, that people who come on this course have to be doing it in some shape or form. Because it creates, not only is it we've identified them, they're doing it, there's no, you know, it's a big selection criteria that we're not looking for people who aspire to do it, but if they're doing it, there's a much greater chance they'll continue their good people and to invest in. But also in terms of the place that you create for those people, if it's a group of people doing it, their struggles are common, their tensions are common, their problems are common. Even if you've got one that's planting a city farm, which we had, one that was planting a city farm, one that opened one to open nail bars, and one that worked with vulnerable people in a town centre. So their callings were distinctly different, but their challenges in terms of working within the church and getting what they were doing up and off the ground were actually strangely common. There was a greater commonality of combination of conversation between those three people than there often is between three ministers and three almost identical churches. And that was interesting for us. So these people are doing it. The other thing that we find around identifying, that how do you know they're a pathfinder, is story. And I've missed this off the slide, so apologies for that. What I found and what I've found since is, as I went around to talk to these pathfinders centres, and I'll say, tell me how you started. They all, almost without exception, and even those who didn't come first, when I did a bit of digging, they had it. They had a founding story. I'm going to cry. Every time I tell this story, it's really difficult for me. I'd have never been able to tell this story to a group without crying, because it's the most amazing story. But I've never, forgive me for this, because you've seen me really confident, and as soon as I get to this story, I start to crack up, because it's the most amazing story. Thank you. Got some dishes. When I was talking to this woman, I was streaming. Woman in India. No, Sri Lanka. I went to see her because I was sent there. They said, go and meet this partner. So I went to meet the partner, and she's working. And I said, tell me how you started. She said, well, my husband was a travel photographer. He worked for Condé Nast. And he went around the world to the most beautiful hotels. And it was great, but I just had two kids, and I was traipsing around after him, staying in these five-star hotels. It's a tough life for some people. She said, but, you know, so there's something going on to me. And she said, one day on the beach in Sri Lanka, which is where her husband based himself because it's a good place to position around these luxury hotels. She said they came, they had a picnic as a family, and another family came up. This isn't a bit abnormally quiet, so forgive me. Although it's tragic, deeply tragic. Poor family came up and the family asked, can we share your picnic? We've got no food. So it's a rich middle-class family, luxury lifestyle. They said, yeah, sure, okay, we'll share with you what we've got. Every Sunday they carried meeting on the beach with this couple, with this family. One day the child was, one of their children was seriously ill and they said, your child's ill, we need to get them to hospital. They got the child to hospital. Within 2 days that child had died. It was foundational for this woman. A rug was pulled from under her. What do I do? What do I do about this? So his family's like this all over Sri Lanka, and here I am traveling this five-star lifestyle with my husband. What do I do, and how do I do this? Somebody said she should read Jackie Bullinger's book, Chasing the Dragon. So she did. And then she went off with her husband, and they went, and they stayed on the Maldives, because that's what they did. She was walking on the beach, and she said, Lord, just find me someone who I can work with this stuff. She saw two people under a palm tree, and she said, they were reading the New Testament, NIV together, and they got talking. She said, I've been praying. Can you pray with me? I've read this book. It's by Jackie Pullinger. You know where this is going. And the woman in the tree said, I'm Jackie Pullinger. Forgive me, every time I tell that story, it just cracks me. 10 years later, this woman has an AIDS clinic, a primary school, a feeding program. The most amazing ministry in Colombia. But every time I tell the story, I can't keep a straight face. So apologies for that. That's gone now. Back on with a mask. Just an amazing, amazing story. And so that was probably the most astonishing founding story I heard. But that founding story fueled this woman in terms of what she was doing. And almost every pioneer I've met has a founding story of some shape or other that says, thank you for the tissues, that says, this affected me in this way. This has become my story. This is my rock. And that's so foundational in terms of their fuel for the future. Not only does it help us to identify them, it helps resource them for the future and what they're doing. Some other stories are Amory Wilson, who's a CMS mission partner, founded 28 Too Many, the anti-FGM group. She was traveling through Africa and met one girl who was suffering severely, having been gone through FGM at a young age and then having significant medical complications following that. She thought, what do I do? What do I do? And she went on to found 28 Too Many. Jane's thing was, I'm a teacher, my passion is teaching. You know, I've had teaching in my blood from a young age, and now I find myself in northern India where none of these kids have education. What do I do? It's my founding story. It's so primary and principal to what's going on. Okay. The other things that supported them was they need the support of a spouse. And I use the word spouse in very broad terms. In terms of some people, that's an actual husband or wife. In the instance of some of the single people like Amory Wilson, it's a close friend who is just going to stick with them no matter what because the journey that they're on is a tough one. So the support of the spouse is really primarily important for them. They need specialist mentors. This is where accountability comes in. They need someone they meet on a regular basis who has an understanding of what it is they do at their level of practice. So this isn't around the pathfinder, the authority dissenter. It's someone else other than that who enables them to find a space to talk around what they're doing and process what they're doing within what's going on. So if that's around, actually, I'm a children and young families worker on a new estate, they need to find somebody else who has more experience of doing that kind of work they can use as a mentor because it's a specialist mentoring stuff is really useful. They need a theological framework, and this comes into the gender issue, but it sits elsewhere as well. One of the stories I had was when I was in India, I met some of the guys that used to work for navigators, and they were navigators in India, so they had quite a conservative framework in terms of how they were working, very conservative eschatology in terms of what was saying. Their job was to get people out of hell and into heaven, and that's our primary job. One day, all three of them, they came out of the station in Delhi where they were working, and they almost tripped over the same guy. So one person came out on the way into the office and they tripped over the same guy. He was basically dying in his own vomit just outside the train station. And it stuck with one. And then another one came, then he goes to the office. Then somebody else comes to the office saying, I'm sorry, in our prayers today, I'm going to have to stop because there was this guy I almost stepped on as I came out of the station. He was dying. And the third one said, I've got the same story. What does this mean? Because within their theology, within their eschatology, if they could have got to this guy sooner, maybe before he was about to die, then they could do something. But what can they do now is very little. So they need a theological framework in which they can justify making an intervention in a different way. For women, there needs to be a theological framework for why your voice is valid when others come up with a theological framework against you to why your voice is invalid. And you need to know that and stand your ground and say, no, this is where I am. And work alongside others who stand in that place as well. But theological frameworks for these guys are really critical in terms of how they're working. Cool. I'll jump to the next bit and then we'll take a bit of a stretch and a toilet break if that's good with people. So, classic ones. These are... one of our founding principals was Henry Venn. So CMS founding people was a chap called Henry Venn. His great-grandson that went and created the mathematical Venn diagram. Point of interesting fact. But actually his great-grandson lost his faith before he did that. But Henry Venn was one of the founding kind of fathers of CMS, as it were, and he wrote in his diaries. And he came up with, he had founding principles for planting churches, which is they need to be self-sustaining, self-theologizing, which is quite the common Venn principles. There were some uncommon Venn principles, which we use as an organization, and I'll talk around what these are. So what Pathfinders, when you're doing this, start primarily with prayer. Venn says start with prayer. Prayer is your starting point. In many senses, your ending point. Start with prayer in what you're doing. The next point for Venn is start with the right people. Identifying those pathfinders. Are these people the right people to be working with? Start with those good people. The next one is start small. You might have big dreams, but your practice has to start small. Don't start with a big program. No, start small. Start with vision. You've got to have a vision for what it is you're doing. So that vision might be big, but you've got to have a vision of where you're going and what you're wanting to do with this. The last one, money follows prayer, people and vision. Money is last. So often, I'll speak as CMS as an organization, we trip up when we break these principles. Whenever we come to a problem and say, well, if we've got the money to deal with it, bad footing, it goes wrong. Anytime we come up with a big plan and we've got the money to do it and we put a big plan in place, something goes wrong. Anytime we go and think of saying we start a recruitment process and we end up requiring, fundamentally start employing the least worst person we see, it's profoundly problematic and trips us up. These Venn principles have sustained us, and when we fail against them. Go on.
Can you say on that first one, what is the prayer? I say start with prayer, but what is the prayer that you're praying? Praying about what?
Praying, good. Then the starting point is often the challenge, the opportunity, or the problem. So, therefore, it might be a problem we're facing. Blimey, we see this, Lord. What should we do around that problem that we see? It might be a challenge in terms of going, this is really sticky. It's not quite a problem. I don't know whether we'd frame it as a problem, but it's a challenge that we've got. We need to pray around this. Or here's an opportunity with someone that's walked towards us. Stop. Let's pray about this first. Rather than what our temptation is to quickly jump in and say, how can we align resources around it? It's the wrong place to start. Given that these were written nearly 200 years ago, they're not bad principles. But often some of the principles are from our oldest books, I think we'll find. So, cool. Those are some founding principles for us around these kind of pathfinders. I hope that's been a helpful introduction. Conscious that over these couple of hours I've got, in one sense I'm taking the top off the jar and putting it on the side and spilling a few things out for you that we could look at in more depth. Hopefully it's provided some spark for you. Before we move on, so this was I talked about two paths at the beginning, the path of descent, which has been these things, and the path of descent, going down, which is what I'll be exploring with you next. Any questions on this that I can close with before we stop for a toilet break?
Just one of the things that I've been thinking about is
Yeah.
To understand this idea that this person has or this group has, do we think it might be what God wants us to do or not? Can you talk about that discernment process?
Yeah, I'll try. Because by the nature of it being a discernment process, it's a path that no one can quite lead you down. Things I would consider in that process would be, I would be coming back to the people and explore some of the motivations. Why would you want this outside the church? What's going on there? Why would you want this inside the church? What's going on? Why would you want to do this in the name of the church? What's happening and what's going on? Because there might be a series of unspoken and unexplored motivations that are going on within that you would need to do within the discernment process. So when we do selection for mission partners at CMS, people going overseas, is much more rigorous than it is for our pioneers, because with our pioneers we're doing a training program, so we don't carry the same degree of responsibility, as it were, in quite the same way as we do when we're lifting someone out of their home and putting them on the other side of the world. But in that, we really get underneath what are some of their motivations to try and unearth, what are some of the unspoken things that are going on for someone. And it's important that we do that in what we do. Because for some it might be, I want to do it within the place of the church because it's a safe place. I'll be talking about this when we come back after the break. And actually, I want to do it within the church because actually I feel like I will get money if I do it that way. So finding a space where you can have these conversations openly and honestly enables you to do the recruitment, because that's effectively what you're doing, you're recruiting these people in a way that we've got everything out on the table, we know what's going on, and we're having a good conversation around these things. Creating a space to do that is quite an art, because they have to feel safe to go, do you know what, I realised I did that, and I'm not doing that for good motive. And that's okay, we're not saying no, we're just saying let's talk about it. Let's uncover everything that we've got going on. It might be somebody says, I want to do this outside of the church because they've got a broken relationship in the church that you don't know about. That's not a good starting point. So it's all of those things going on in terms of that discernment. What are the motives? And you have to create a prayerful space to do that within. I think it's one of the things that we do poorly within organisations around recruitment is how long do we give to the actual process itself? And how do we create safe places within that process? That somebody can confess something. Actually, I realise I'm doing this out of a place where I'm fearful for money. And that doesn't mean we're going to stop the process there, but it's good to know that before we continue the process. And we have exactly the same thing with mission partners. So these things might come unstuck during the process, but it doesn't mean it's a no. Far better to go ahead with that someone knowing it than going ahead with them not knowing it. Some of those things. Good. Should we stop for literally a 3-minute toilet break? Is that good with people? Great, go. I will start again in 5 minutes. That might be an incentive or disincentive. We'll see. Okay, 1, 2, 2, 2. Okay, can you hear me? Good. Take seats, if you could. I will. I'll start with a joke. Do any of you know the back on your heads joke? Like, when you get a group gathering like this, you can say back on your heads, and then you can tell the joke. The joke is a guy. It's bad eschatology, but I'll tell the joke anyway. Guy dies, and he realizes he's not been a good bloke, so he's taken by a head demon down into hell. And he said, well, now you're down in hell for eternity. You can choose one of these three rooms to be in. So he just looks for the windows of each of the rooms, and you can make your choice. So he goes, well, it's a bit rough, but it's an eternity. You ought to make a good choice. He opens the window of one, and he sees people being flailed. He says, oh, forget that one. Next room. They're being stretched over the kind of the racks. He says, oh, forget that one. Next room, he opens the window. People standing around having a cup of tea. He said, kind of just above the knee in raw sewage. But he thinks, well, not really a choice, is it? You know, a bit hot, unpleasant, but drinking tea for an eternity, showing to people, I think I'll do that. So he goes, oh, I'll choose a third room. So he goes, fine, head demon in here. He goes, well, head demon in that room says, right, chaps, tea's over, back on your heads. Good. The next journey or part in conversation is a little bit of a trickier one in many senses. It's what I'm going to be doing is talking about really a plug for the 72 process of what's going on, because how do you lead through dissent in different ways and working with dissent. And to start this conversation, I'd like to talk about strangely, ego shape in leadership. This has come from Simon Walker's work on undefended leadership stuff. Again, I worked with Simon for a couple of years and found his work and his guidance really, really valuable. In this model I'm going to show you, what we're going to be talking about is levels of trust in yourself and levels of trust in others. Okay? Levels of trust in self and level of trust in others. And some great stories that we can tell from this and from current political shenanigans around what might be going on for different people within this. But each of us have been shaped in our ego, if you like, through this, how much do we trust ourselves and how much do we trust others? And what does this do to us in terms of our relationship with the communities of people that we're in? And where does God intervene within this is a huge question. It takes this space and turns it into four places, for want of a way of dividing it up and talking about it. The first place is a place called defending. In the defending space, you've got a very low trust of yourself and a very low trust of others as well. So the character in this place has a defending ego, which is probably quite small, because if they can't trust themselves and they can't trust others as well, nothing is reliable. If they can't trust my own instincts or what I believe about myself, and I can't trust someone that's come near to me, how on earth can I shape what I'm doing in the world or in life? Yeah? Does that feel familiar to you? You've met people like that. In another place, where someone has a higher trust of others, but a lower trust of self, they're adapting person. Because what they might be doing is looking for affirmation from someone else that they're doing the right thing and that's okay, because and how I will respond to someone else will really depend on how much they affirm me and what I'm doing. So I will change what I'm doing according to what you want, if that's okay, because that seems to be what you would like me to do. Yeah? That person has what we would call an adapting ego, where X is perceived as fragile. So when we say X, that means family, church, community, others that we're around, becomes a fragile place. And defending, everything is unreliable. Nothing is safe. In the adapting place, everything is fragile because it's dependent upon the responses of others as towards this is a safe place or not a safe place. And the next place is defining, where the trust of self is very strong. I'm not the problem. It's everyone else. And therefore, what I have to do in that space is I have to pull down where the barriers are, and I have to say what's going on. And if I dare say that it's going to be a big wall, and it's going to, you are not going to see better walls. Because I'm dictating the conversation, I'm dictating the space, and I'm creating this space, and I'm the definer in what's going on. Because X is conditional. I will engage with you if you work on my agenda, because I know what's going on, and I'm the safe place. I can trust myself, but I can't trust anyone else. Yeah? So they will shape what's going on around them according to that level of conditionality. The next place that Simon talks about is the shaping place, which is where you've got high trust of others and a high trust of self as well. I want to unpack this bit because your initial response might be that's a positive place as well, but I'll unpack it a bit. In this, everything is perceived as positive. So family and church and community, everything's good. It's really good. And actually, I want to work with you to make this great, to make this thing really work. And actually, I want to join and I want to bring more people in. And I want us to all work together. And this could be really fantastic because it's good and it's safe and it's brilliant. But what's the problem in working in that space or having an ego shape like that? Why not? Thank you. Because you're naturally working with others around here, it's not at all. Do you follow? If you're working with other people and actually your ego shape is shaping, but actually you're working with someone, you've got people in your congregation who are defending people, then actually making that space a safe place isn't as easy as you perceive it to be. Because it's not. So when we're talking about working within groups and moving with change through groups, I think for me this is one of the most interesting models that I play with and I work with around what is the ego shape of myself as a leader, but also those who I'm leading. That's at an individual level. The next question is also, what is this, as it were, what's the ego shape of this group of people? How many of you have worked in a church which feels like it's adapting, which it wants to be, you know, sort of, it doesn't quite know itself enough, and so therefore it will bend and twist according to some of the louder voices around it? Or those of us who've worked in a defining church, which they know this is how it is, and these are our walls, and this is very clear, and it's very simple, and you're in a boat or you're not in it, and it's very clear. So the shape of the communities that we work in matter significantly in terms of how you manage change within those organizations because of the ego shape of the people, but also the collective ego shape, as it were, that we're working within. I wanted to put that as a proviso, as it were, in terms, and you can unpack that within your own time. That's within Simon Walker's book for more explanation on it, which is the undefended leader stuff. But it's very interesting for me how I know myself within this. Because I go to one of two places. Most of us operate on two paradigms within this. I do this. I'm shaping or I'm adapting, shaping or adapting, because my trust in others is actually very high. And that's probably because I was raised in a safe household, constant mum and dad are still alive, grandparents through most of my life, broadly affirming of what I did. You know, I had 8 CSEs when I left school. The next thing I did was a master's, but that's a different story. So my life is very good. So my trust in others is high. But because there have been times in my life when I've suffered from anxiety and depression, my trust of self can sometimes feel a little bit shaky. And so often I will look towards others for affirmation. Knowing that for myself has been profoundly helpful. And knowing when I'm working with other people, what I'm doing, what's the environment that I'm creating has helped me enormously when working with organizations around change. What am I walking into? Because if I ever walk into this place, it can be quite toxic for me. Because it's like, whoa, this is so unfamiliar to me. My visceral response to Donald Trump is a negative one. From it simply, it's he sits in a defining space. But he also sits in a defending space. Because his view of others is so low. Go on.
My trust that you're not going to trip over that microphone stand is very low.
Is it higher now? Thank you.
Yeah. Quick question. Given that I think that one of the key tasks
say it's going to be fine, it's going to be all right. Yeah. Are you saying that, using that as an example, and it will be true wherever we find ourselves on there, that the tendency for me to lead in that way can potentially really wind up the defenders, for example, because they're thinking it's not going to be all right, and you're saying it is, and you're not telling me why?
That's right. Because you're not, because it's not a safe place for me. In that sense, I joined church because it was a safe place. There were clear boundaries. And I knew what was right and I knew what was wrong. And now you're coming in telling me this is multicolours. And that's profoundly unsettling in different ways.
Can I say this? It's conflict perception sometimes. Yes. If I say it as somebody who works with Matt, sometimes, yes, you're right, that is unhelpful.
Welcome the feedback. Welcome the feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on. Absolutely.
Strengths
and weaknesses. And largely in terms of working within groups and leadership teams, it's about the conversation around these things. So one of the exercises that I do, if this was a smaller group, if we had 15 of us in a room, I'd bring out a massive piece of brown paper and on it I'd draw a mountain and I would say, tell us about your stories of being led, using the mountain as a metaphor and stay within the metaphor of climbing a mountain. People do all sorts of things like, oh, this leader, he sat down here in a nice base camp and he kept sending us up the mountain. And we would go up the mountain and some of us would die on there, but he always stayed down here in this base camp. It's a helpful way to process that. So in a small team, you can actually sit there with this mountain and say, at times it feels like you do this. At times it feels like we're working like this. So therefore, we're exposing ourselves in terms of where some of our vulnerabilities are around the change that we're facing. Because we will sit in different places. And this stuff does not change easily. Interestingly enough, who was it who pointed the Times article to me? Thank you. You found a brilliant article, front page of the Times today. People do change over a 70-year period. We're not fixed static. And some research has done some stuff. They found some research that was done with kids 50 years ago. And they've did it with 2,000 kids, and they found 650-odd of them. And repeated some of the same questionnaires and went to see what had changed. Really interesting stuff, and it had changed. But who was I talking to about now? Was it Leslie? With your age, forgive me. Tell us about your story about, and now you're older, how do you feel and what's your response? Yeah.
And for me, that's a massive step, isn't it, Nigel?
Couldn't possibly say.
But go on.
Thank you.
I'm wondering how much space this language of leadership leaves for the notion of ministry in the church.
Oh, I think that's a really pertinent point. I think it's a really pertinent point because I think the language of leadership has come in too much into the nature of what it is to be ministry. And that's definitely, to me, one side of the coin, absolutely. And I listen to the critics of what's called the renewal and reform agenda within the church of England and say, you're trying to turn everyone into managers and leaders when actually we're ministers. And on the other side of the coin, I can also say, and who's bringing some critical thinking to what it is to be a minister in this day and age? So I hear both of those arguments as well. And I'm completely with you. How much is the language of leadership? Therefore, we could take leadership out of this and say, ego-shaping ministry. Well, ministry is a place of opening up spaces on many levels.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you for that. That's really helpful. One of the things, I don't do it anymore because I don't teach this level of leadership stuff, but on guys who work at certificate level on our Pioneer stuff, used to do the leadership thing, and I used to get them to watch three films. The three films I used to get them to watch were Of Gods and Men. You've seen that? Fascinating story of ministry and leadership, holding that word lightly, within a monastic community and what that meant for them. Jerry Maguire, fascinating story of transforming leadership, and also a story of descent, story of a downward story of collapse as well. But all good stories have a point of collapse in them. If any of you have seen Kurt Vonnegut's story, there's only ever one type of story in the world, and it goes like this. It starts off bad, it gets a little better, then it gets really bad. And then it goes up again, and at the end, it's much better than it was. So there was only one type of story, and that's it. But that nature and that narrative of doing that within Jerry Maguire is really clear. The last one I get to watch, which I'd encourage all of you to watch, is a film called The Way Back. The Way Back is a film which is based on a true story, which there are very few sources of material to know it's a true story, so they've had to really colour in some big details on it. And the story is of a guy who was arrested during the Second World War in East Poland, I believe it was, by the Russians when they took over the area, so just at the end of the Second World War, and was taken and put into a camp in Siberia. And he escapes with a few others from this camp, and they walk from Siberia to northern India. And they believe it's a true story because there's a couple of accounts of family members who said, my father always talked about that story, and he said he did it, but we never believed him. And then there was another story which confirmed it in some way. So there is strong belief that a group of people escaped from an internment camp in Siberia and walked to India. But the film is fantastic because how it explores this dynamic of leadership between a group of guys who are learning to trust each other, and where is leadership between them, leadership ministry, isn't the holding of one, but is a collective thing. But they believe at different times that it's one or other of them. And how they negotiate that is a great and fascinating story. But creating spaces where we're able to talk around these things is tricky. But unless you're able to do that, you will do, coming back to our earliest point, in terms of discernment, how do you discern this person's a good pathfinder dissenter or bad one? How do we discern? And how do we talk about ministry and leadership as a group of people according to what we're doing, how we're working through change? Finding the space for that is not only critical, it's kind of essential, but also profoundly difficult. So finding a good facilitator to work through that stuff is important.
You talked about people having a preference.
Yeah. Part of me is tempted to go to Walter Wink then, if those of you know Walter Wink, in terms of discerning the powers and his powers trilogy, which I've got a lot of sympathy with. And within this, Walter Wink's got a discerning the powers thing. There are spiritual forces in some ways, but actually how those work, he's got a model and a method for saying that. But also, I think, in that, also Walter Wink points towards that powers are created and dispersed as well. They come and they go. And I think when a group defines itself as being in a particular place, it will attract others of that ilk. So I think it can you end up with a like attracts like dynamic going within it. And therefore you find that within traditions as well. But yesterday I was talking to someone around, we're so post-denominational in how we're working, but we are moving towards a place of being in tribes in the church. And actually some of those tribes are created around festivals, so New Wine, Spring Harvest, Keswick, Greenbelt, yeah? So they have, these tribes have gatherings in different ways, but they're not denominations because they're interdenominational. So understanding the tribes are interesting, and do tribes likes attract like within what's going on is an interesting point.
Go on. So in this,
yeah.
A pathfinder dissenter must be defending or defining, because presumably a pathfinder dissenter has a low trust in the status quo, therefore trust of others and the way they're doing things.
No, not necessarily at all. They could have a massive trust in what's going on over there, and that's brilliant, but actually their founding story says they've got to do something different. We were talking just in the coffee break, weren't we? What's your name, sorry?
Guy,
thank you. You were saying in the break when I was sharing the founding story of the woman who met Jackie Pullinger, each of you in this room will have a founding story, and that can massively shift your life direction quite quickly as a big interruption. And actually, we talked about in Scripture, so much of Scripture, their stories are of defining stories in people's lives in different ways. So I think you can have an interrupting, defining story, regardless of where your ego shape is, that says you're called to go into a different direction. So it might be that you still have massive trust in others, but actually that's your calling, and you can't do anything to dispel that. And God bless everywhere you've come from and all those good people in your recent past, but your calling is now over here, and that's okay. Good. Any other questions on this? I had to bring that in because I thought with the rest of what we're talking about is massively shaped, I think, in terms of what are we working with and what's the material and the people we've got. I like this from Richard Rohr as well. This is one of his quotes from one of his daily readings. So, the Spirit will help you in your weakness. From this most positive and dignified position, you can let go and even easily admit your wrongs. You are being held so strongly and so deeply that you can stop holding on to or defending yourself. God forever sees and loves Christ in you. It is only we who doubt our divine identity as children of God. That a profound, I like these about Richard Rohr, kind of his crafting of words in things, I think is fantastic. His argument is very much when we truly experience our grounding in God, our defending nature washes away. And most of us only learn that in age. Because it's through those experiences that we find ourselves being transformed. So looking for those transformational encounters with God that enable ourselves to get out of the way of what the Spirit is doing. Just get out of the way. Get out of the way of what the Spirit is doing. How do I get out of the way? And yet at the same time have good responsibility and accountability is a massive paradox for ministry, it seems to me. As I said, I'll leave the laptop up so you can... I'll send this PowerPoint to you. Oh, yeah. This might be a leadership thing that you're very familiar with. This is a classic leadership quote that you get quoted in different ways all the time. A leader is best when the people barely know she exists. When her work is done, her aim fulfilled, they will say we did it ourselves. How many of you heard that quote before? Yeah, very common. It's nice. It's lovely. I'm not knocking it at all. But I think our experience of leadership can actually be quite different to that, even very effective leadership. Because I think the leadership through descent will take you to a different place. And therefore, I want to tell you a different parable of leadership. And this is one that I shared with Patrick Kiefert, who's from Church Innovations in the States. And said, for many of us, our experience of leadership is this. A group of people, one day, have set out and they've got a vision that they want to go to a new land. And they gather themselves and they gather their resources and they think that's fantastic. And they hear they've got to cross over the top of one mountain. And when they get to the other side of that mountain, someone will be there with a boat for them to get to another shore. And then they can create the promised land that's there. And they go, fantastic, we get it. And they're up and they go and they have a difficult climb of that mountain. And it's really tricky and it's really quite painful. But they get over the other side and they see on the other side someone waiting for them. They think that's fantastic. Here is the leader with the boat. Who's going to be able to take us on their boat to the promised land? And they're really enthusiastic about this. And they arrive there, and then this rather ineffective-looking guy with a book on boat building. And their hearts sink. They think, who's this joker? Why is this person here? Somebody take the book off him. If we're going to have to build this boat ourselves, let's figure this out. So they take the book off him, and he's able to say, well, it's quite well thumbed, and I've done a little bit of boat building myself. And they say, well, thanks. Good news, you've done a bit of boat building. It would have been helpful if you bought a boat, because then we could have got to the other side. So eventually, over 2 or 3 days of camping on the shoreline, they've managed to cobble together, and they've built actually a pretty sturdy boat from the book this guy had that was well thumbed. And in the boat they get, and they go across to the other land, and they get there. leaving the guy behind, thank goodness we got rid of him. What help has he been? And they continue, and then they're going to find another mountain to climb, but what they weren't expecting was another river to cross. And they've left their boat behind, but it's okay, because now, thanks to themselves, they've learned how to build boats. So they build another boat that enables them, and they say, thank goodness we didn't take that guy with us. So not only that the leader is not noticed within these contexts of change, but the leader can often be blamed, the minister can be often be blamed, when what they did was not only lead well, but lead towards self-sufficiency. And that community won't thank that leader for not having the boat, but they will self-congratulate themselves on being good boat builders without understanding they were only good boat builders because the leader didn't take a boat.
Isn't that about equipping saints for works of service?
Yeah, totally. But when we say equipping, coming back to these points of change again, equipping can often be read technical change, not adaptive change. That parable is a parable of adaptive versus technical change. The technical change would be, give me a boat. The adaptive change is, here's a thumb book around boat building. Do we think we've got the resources around here that we think we can do something with? It's a mind shift. Blimey, I'm going to have to do something different with that.
That notebook, I'll just tell you stories about it.
Yeah, do. Sorry?
I have no book, but I have stories about the other side. You work it out.
Yeah, that would also be his thing. Then that's the old story of, don't tell me how to build a boat, give me a passion for the sea. I think that's absolutely true. But in those points of transitions, as a minister and as a leader, we're not thanked for doing that. We're thanked when we're given the technical change rather than the adaptive change of what's gone on. Yeah. So you hope within that you're also intrinsically passing on. One of the next slides of coming up is a quote from Socrates. The point of education is not to fill a vessel, but kindle a fire. So kindling fire for transformation is what we're in the game of, really. And how do you kindle fire? Gethsemane. Because it's a Gethsemane experience that these guys appreciate with, that you sit through them in all forms of adaptive change. Just the sitting and the sweating and the crying and the working out that goes on. This is a drawing done by Johnny Baker. Bless him. The ideas come from Jerry Arbuckle, but the drawing came from Johnny. And I said, rather than try and recreate, Johnny, have you got the drawing that you did? And he did it on his iPad while Jerry Arbuckle was talking. I'm going to talk it through with you. You start here at the founding story, and that founding story can be that story of transformation that we were talking about. Somebody saying, we've got to go in this direction. This is my burning passion here that we've got and that I want to do. And what they tried to do is then they've got, but reality's up here. So the reality of the situation they're in is a contradiction to their founding story. Coming back to that boat thing, founding story is we're going to go to that new land, but actually the reality is we've got no boat. So they go down, and their energy dissipates for what they're doing. At that point, you need to re-engage people with the gospel. You need to re-engage people with their new eschatology. What are they there for? What's going on? What's their purpose? But the gospel will, by its nature, take them through Gethsemane. It will take them to a place which is uncomfortable and pleasant, which they will want to fall asleep in rather than face. But that can take them back, if they're positive, into their founding story again, to a place where they can create a different reality. Jerry Arbuckle's argument is you can't go through this thing expecting good news all the way. If the gospel story tells us anything, it's a paschal story, because the Catholics love the paschal mystery, and I can see why, that takes them through the life, the death, the resurrection, the life, the death, the resurrection, the life, the death, the resurrection. And actually that story is our story as a community of people in God. So we should not shy away from it in transformation, because it's also a transforming story. But the resurrection that we get on the other side isn't what we expected it to be. It's something other. It's always something other. It's never as we expect to see it. But that's very difficult for us to work with groups and congregations over. This I love. This is a quote from Vincent Donovan, Christianity and Rediscovered, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. In the middle of it, he says this. He says, in working with young people, we do not try to call them back to where they were and do not call them to where you are, as beautiful as that place may seem to you. You must have the courage to go with them to a place that neither you nor they have been before. And that's a very difficult process to go through. And in terms of signposting you forward, I can only signpost you towards the 72 program, because its nature is designed as a process by which you can walk people towards a new place that at the moment you do not perceive. But coming back to here, it's a path of descent. It's a path through the Paschal mystery, through the life, living in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus that we see ourselves going through. All the people with founding stories experience death within that founding story, whether that's Anne-Marie meeting the young girl who'd been so horribly abused through FGM, was such a touching point of Gethsemane for her, or whether it's the woman who on the beach met the couple with the dying child. Such a horrible touch point with reality, such a Gethsemane point that changed them forever, really, in what they do. And what are the founding points in terms of some of our stories? I'll talk a minute about some work I did with the Methodists some years ago that was not easy work. It was only a one-day workshop I did with them. But their stories of what was going on for them in the Methodist church was quite painful. And it's taken me years to try and understand why it might be so painful for them, because what they were doing, they were trying to merge these Methodist churches in the Midlands, because as they were getting smaller and smaller, so there was a greater need to merge them with each other. And there was such resistance to merging them, because they would turn up and say, my grandfather laid that founding stone, I will leave this church over my body. Because their path had been one of ascent, not learnt to descend and to allow us to be tripped up by God. This is a great quote from one of the mystics, which said, the only fun that God can have in the world now is to pull the rug from under us. How do we allow that to happen? How do we allow ourselves to go through those points of transformation where we're letting go, going, following Christ through his death, through Gethsemane, through to what that resurrection might look like? But as we've learned from New Eschatology, it ain't what we think it'll look like, and we don't necessarily recognize it. It's a profound challenge. I'll stop there, coming back to this last point from Socrates. Our education is the kindling of a flame, not the filling of a vessel. So coming back to this thing of a passion for traveling the seas, regardless of what that might entail, not the technical challenge of here's a tool, here's a program, here's an easy way through something, which is a profoundly difficult message to work with. But it seems to me as if it's our calling. But I'd be interested in your responses. I'll stop there and take questions. Thank you for your patience. Any thoughts or reflections?
That whole thing about trusting in the unchanging character and promises of God.
Yeah. I didn't know how familiar you'd be with liminality, but liminality and Gethsemane are very similar for Jerry Arbuckle. It's you're taken through this point. And I did try and find a quote that I've lost now from, I used to use it many years ago in change management stuff within organizational small change management, which said, it's not so much that we miss where we have been. We're in love with where we're going. It's the place between that we hate. And it's that transition which is a point of liminality between these things where I knew where I was and I know what that might look like, but actually the journey through them is so profoundly uncomfortable. But what do I do with that? And what do we do with that as a community, as a congregation, through change processes? That's one of the things that was going on for the Methodists, is you're taken to a point of liminality where you're closing both of these churches, or you're moving, or you're redesigning something. And actually, that's profoundly uncomfortable. We're not trained for that. As people, as human beings, we're trained for success and for accomplishment and to complete exams and to be good workers, not to hold ourselves through points of liminality.
It's fine, but it's relevant for other people. I was just interested, you talked a bit about pioneer stuff, that, but I was kind of interested if this is the same or sort of different, but can I hear a bit about the resourcing churches that have sparked up now? Is that the same? Is that different? Is there ways in which some of this stuff applies to that?
Good.
I realise it's kind of early days in some ways, so it'd be interesting to see how that happens in the future. But
no, I think it does. I think it does profoundly, actually. And I think it fits in with what's going on. But no one's recording this, are they? Good. Within the church... no, it's okay. My name's Jim Barker. I work for the Church Mission Society. I own what I'm about to say. So one of the strategies in the reform and renewal work that Church of England's done is what they've tried to do is identify what they would term resource churches. The best model that we have for that is HDB in London. So HDB was a very profoundly successful evangelical charismatic church in London. Holy Trinity, and they planted a series of churches through London through a process of church transplanting. So where they found a struggling church which has a large building but maybe a congregation of 15 people or less, what they've done is they said, we can work and take that, and they take the resources from a mother church, which tends to be about 20 to 30 people, and a minister and a stipend for a period of time, but those 20 to 30 people pay for that church. And they move and transplant that, and then it becomes like a HDB plant, effectively. And I think that's a great model. I'm not knocking it on one level. But for me, the idea that you can, it's in terms of this, I think there is a concern that therefore we've found a successful model of what's going on. And therefore, that's interesting, right? If anybody heard that, it says, that's not what you said. So there's a sense in which you're on a trajectory, therefore, of we can replicate this and we know what it looks like. So how much are we in step with the Spirit? Having said that, we've been meeting with the former minister of St. Paul Shadwell, who's now the bishop of church planting in London. And he's saying what was interesting, they moved to Shadwell and they expected the kind of yuppie thing, and this was his language, to continue as well in Shadwell. But when people moved into the areas, they start engaging with their Muslim neighbours and the Muslim shopkeepers, and they thought, well, what does this mean in terms of who we are as church? And that's left them with big questions. Actually, it's helped them through that transition. So in one sense, but in other places, it's been, this feels like a HTB2 in St. Paul's Onslow Square or others like that. So the idea of Church of England is great. We'll plant one of these in Birmingham, we'll put one in Sheffield, and we'll put one in Manchester, and it'll repeat. But my argument is, actually, I think it's working because through a process of gentrification. Those churches grew through periods of London as London was being broadly gentrified. And actually they moved into points of gentrification as well. That's not a bad thing. But the idea that you can move to London, then they're going to plant in Borstal Heath, I kind of doubt it. You know, or you can take one of those and plant it in Cradley Heath. I think actually those contexts are so different. But it would be interesting to see how it works out for them. Yes. In Oxford, what we did was, what happened back in 2002, each of the dioceses had a windfall from the church commissioners, and the windfall was £250,000 per diocese. This is what happens in the Church of England. Came down from the church commissioners. Now, some dioceses, yes, it caused you depression, sorry about that. But actually, what we've done with that money, whether that's squandered or not, is an interesting point, because a lot of dioceses just use that to plug their financial deficit. not necessarily the smartest use of resources. In Oxford, what they did was they said, okay, let's create something called cutting-edge ministries, which was before Fresh Expressions, and I was part of one of those first cutting-edge ministries. And then, again, under the blessing of the bishop, they said, we've got these four projects. One was called Contemplative Fire, which was a kind of contemplative monastic community. One was a group called Maybe, that was headed up by Ian Adams. I was part of Home, that was headed up by a chap called Matt Rees. iChurch came out of that, and then also there was another estate church, which was under Penny's name will come back to me in a minute, in Whitney in Oxfordshire, they built a massive estate that was the same size as Cogs Parish in Whitney, and she was put onto that estate to work. And Penny was one of the first estate workers. So therefore, they wanted to get learning from that. But that was Bishop Colin of Dorchester, who then said, no, I'm going to create the space for this. We're not going to use this to plug the deficit. We're going to try to do something different. Bad luck, kids. So therefore, that was his thing. And actually, that had the approval of the diocese secretary. He said, no, we should do that. We should see where that goes and learn from that. And that was really helpful for the learning of Fresh Expressions as well. So again, the authority dissenter in that sense, being the bishop, has really helped in the same way it is for the resource churches and other examples. Good. 1:05. Thank you for your patience. It's been a real joy to be spending time with you and sharing, and I hope we'll carry on conversations over the next 24 hours. But thank you. Many blessings.